Welcome to No More Booze, the podcast. I'm Olivia Farrelly, and in every episode, I explore the role that alcohol has in our lives. I interview people who have decided to live their life with no more booze. We'll explore their relationship with alcohol, how it made their life better, how it made their life worse, any lessons they've learned along the way, and what advice they would give to others who are contemplating a life without alcohol. So whether you are sober curious, you're sober serious, or you're already living your life alcohol-free, this podcast will provide inspiration and motivation as you begin to untangle and reassess your relationship with the booze. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to No More Booze, the podcast. Happy second week of January. I hope everybody who's doing dry January is getting on really well. And myself and my gorgeous guest today, we're going to talk a little bit about that after we dive into her story. But I'm deeply inspired by this lady. She has an incredible story, which I think everybody will find really, really interesting, because it is the epitome of bravery and courage and leaving a life behind to pursue new adventures. It is Alison Calder. You are from Manchester. You've been off the booze for 4 and a bit years. Alison, you're so welcome. How are you?
Thank you, Olivia. What a lovely introduction. I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm great. Do you want to tell the listeners just a little bit about yourself, just what you're doing at the minute?
Yeah, so I am an alcohol-free coach. I run group coaching programs. I have an ongoing group coaching and one-to-one coaching. I've also just trained as a firewalk instructor. So I'm putting on some kind of in-person events all about empowerment and walking away from the things that no longer serve us and getting rid of limiting beliefs. So yes, I'm going to be doing more in-person stuff over the next year, but yeah, predominantly working with women who want to change their relationship with alcohol or stop drinking completely.
Beautiful. I love that. And I love, I'm sure the listeners are sick of me saying this, but I'm doing a lot of coaching myself at the minute with a friend of mine, and it's deeply empowering. But just when you say they're limiting beliefs, so like, you know, huge amount of how we are driven in our lives is by the patterns that we've developed along the way. And I suppose when we shine the light on our limiting beliefs and we start dismantling them and disarming them, then that we can kind of, I did a quantum leaping meditation this morning, right? I'm big into that now at the minute. Right. So like, you know, this whole aspect, there's a whole school of thought to say that there's infinite versions of us that exist in the quantum field. Right. So like the version, like, so I was stepping into the version of me that looked like Margot Robbie, because I watched Barbie the other night. So, yeah. So anyway, but that's that's how we begin to dismantle a lot of it, as we step into the version of ourselves that is beyond our wildest dreams.
Yeah, because the version of ourselves, if we're looking at making big changes, the version of ourselves that we are now has the beliefs that we have now. So it's really important to see beyond that and visualize and imagine what that future version would be, like what she would feel and think and what her beliefs would be. Because if we stay in the here and now, then we're stuck with our beliefs that we currently have. And particularly like around alcohol, limiting beliefs are huge in terms of, you know, well, for me and for many of my clients, things like, I'm not going to have any friends. My life's going to be boring. Like, how am I going to, like, how would I ever do this? I'm never going to be able to do it. I don't want to do it, but I have to. And it's going to be awful. And there's just so many beliefs that we have around moving away from alcohol that for most people, well, I don't know anyone actually who's stopped and found it awful and decided to go back because they've not enjoyed being alcohol free. So yeah, for most people, there are so many beliefs that just need to be worked on so that we don't stay stuck.
And those beliefs are heavily supported by the society and the cultural norms around us. So like, there's a rhetoric that goes around in the
in everybody's, well, everybody I've experienced in their little social circles and their little mini cultures, that is, well, it's changing now, but it's very much, oh, I'll ring me when you start drinking again. Oh, look at this boring bollocks coming in the door now. They don't drink, or do you know what I mean? But society supports it until you really start to dismantle it and get them brainwashed.
I don't know. I know that some people will think, genuinely think that, and some people do genuinely think that, oh, you know, you're boring. You're boring if you don't drink. And but I think there's so many people that actually quietly wonder, like, what it might be like for them, or, you know, what, just what it's like, or how you did it. And I found that over the years of people that I would never have expected, like friends, like from school and past work and all of that, have come to me and kind of said, oh, how did you do it? So I think we have this perception that everybody that is drinking loves drinking, and they're so happy with their relationship with alcohol, and they're having so much fun. But we only see the snippets, don't we? The little social media pictures of everyone looking glam at the start of the night. We don't see all the rest of it. And I think there will be those that think, you know, we're boring and would never want to consider going alcohol free. But I think there are also those who quietly wonder, oh, how has she done that? How is she doing? Maybe it could be something that I could explore. I think there are those quiet whispers a lot that maybe people would never say out loud and would never act upon.
Yeah, I think that's such a valid point. And it's our perception of certain people. Oh my God, she's grand, or he's grand with the booze. And then next thing they're like, no, I'm done. And you're like, oh, I thought you had a normal, inverted commas, relationship with it, you know, and then we're all surprised. And I think that the part about your story that I'm so intrigued by, and I think the listeners will be too, is that you, and I think what kind of really sets you apart, is that you worked in the alcohol industry. So like, it was not only part of your social identity, but a huge part of what, of how you worked. Do you want to tell us what you did and how all that came about?
Yeah, so I worked in the wine industry always. So since leaving, or well, being at uni, I trained as a sommelier for a hotel group, so like a wine expert, and then just stayed in the wine industry my whole life, until I had my son. So working for kind of big wine companies, so my job would be to write wine lists for like hotels, restaurants, bars, train their staff on wine, train our staff, so all of that kind of stuff. And then when I had my son, who's now 11, to prevent me from having to be away all of the time, I set up my own wine company, which is a very interesting choice looking back. Because those whispers were definitely there. Well, they were more than whispers at that point, of like, what are you doing? Like, you have an awful relationship with alcohol. At that point, my anxiety was really bad because of my drinking. So I found presenting really difficult. And it was an events company that I was setting up, so it was all about, initially, about presenting. And it just really, with time, worsened the situation I was in with alcohol. So I'd always been a drinker that drank to get drunk from my very first drink. There was always that desire to escape. And it went in waves. And, you know, obviously before the kids, I was out more, and I'd always really, really drink to excess when I was out, but I had social circles that did too. So convinced myself that that was okay. And for a long time, I did stuff. So from 24 was when I first reached out for help with my drinking, and I stopped drinking at 39. So for 15 years there was this knowing, I suppose, that there was something not quite right, but I wasn't ready. Like, I remember when I was 24, someone said, why don't you just leave the wine industry and do something different? And at 24, I was like, no, I can't. This is my career. I've done all my exams, like, I've got my qualifications. I was so closed to the option of like calling it a day then, and I just wasn't ready. I hadn't gone through the years of struggle with alcohol that I had to go to get to a point where, for me, enough was enough. So I set up the wine company, and for a number of reasons, like, I was a new mum, so it was that whole kind of drinking to unwind in the evening, that came in more because I wasn't going out. There was always wine here. We had like thousands of bottles in the garage. So it wasn't that we could open a bottle and then run out and go, oh, the shops are closed, let's go to bed. There was always more wine. And then because it was an events company and all the events were local generally, my identity was like the wine lady. That's what people called me. Like I remember being at a baby sensory class with my daughter and somebody, I was sat next to someone and I was hungover and she went, oh, you're the wine lady. And I remember just kind of sinking a little bit more then because I just, it was just so all consuming in all areas of my life. Like I'd walk the kids to school and I remember again being hungover and someone stopping me and saying, oh, well, you know, I'm thinking of buying some wine, like in the morning when I was hungover and desperately trying to stop. And I just couldn't get away from it. It was really difficult to really try to, I suppose, stop drinking when that was my life and my financial security as well and my identity.
Yeah. So like most of us give up booze and then like we continue working in schools or hospitals or corporate or wherever we work, right? So we can get away from it for a huge amount of time in our lives. But literally, like it is every, and you know, we talk a lot about going from one identity to another. So like this identity I mentioned on here before, like a friend of my husband's, when he told him that I'd given up drinking, he goes, what? Maybe he loves drinking. You know, so like our, that's one part that somebody sees you, but like you have people kind of shouting at you in the street, oh hello Mrs. Wine Lady. You know what I mean? So it's even for me that makes your story just so much more exemplary because you had to untangle from so much. So like bring us back to when I suppose, okay, you're like myself, like there was always kind of a whisper probably, you know, that alcohol's mightn't serving you, like it might be very, very faint, like it might be, it feels like it's coming from a mile away or whatever, and then it just gradually gets closer to it. And then it, at some stage, it's screaming in our face telling us, you know, this is what needs to happen. So maybe the last year of when you were drinking, do you want to tell us how the kind of whispers got louder and louder and louder and when you eventually stopped?
I suppose for me, my big turning point, so I'd had two pregnancies, didn't drink during my pregnancies, so I'd had experience of life without alcohol. And it was just so interesting to me because when I fell pregnant with my son, I was just a bit like, oh my God, like, how am I going to function? I drank at every social occasion, I drank on every emotion, and I just didn't know how I'd do it. And I just found it excruciatingly difficult at the start to go to party. I remember going to a party like a few days after we'd found out and I just hated it. It was so out of my comfort zone. I was so uncomfortable. But I did it and it became gradually just more and more comfortable. And I just remember towards the end of those 9 months, we were living in Weymouth at that point. Because that's where my partner was from. And there was this Frank Sinatra tribute at the seafront. And I was dancing with my partner's mum and her friend to I Did It My Way. And I just remember feeling so happy, you know, that real happiness. And I just remember thinking, you know, I'm up dancing, I've got a massive bump and I don't care. I just felt really at peace and just thought I'm never going to go back. It just seemed so absurd to me at that point. The quantities that I had been drinking, it just felt like somewhere I would never go back to. And it was a slow, like, creep back in after I'd had my son. It wasn't, I got home from the hospital and celebrated with champagne immediately. It was slow, but it did come back and it got to the point of drinking every night, to the point that I was just so low in mood and fed up with myself. And I think when you have that experience of, I'm okay, I'm good without it. And then in 2019, I did a month-long online challenge and succeeded. I completed the month and then carried on for a bit and slipped up. But that was about 6 weeks, again, was game-changing. I had support. I just really got clarity on, right, this is a choice now. It's not because I'm pregnant. It's a choice. And my life is so much better without it. So at that point, I knew I was really clear that I wanted to be alcohol free long term, and that actually it wasn't going to be awful. And it's such a turning point when you get to that point of, I actually feel better and my life's better without it. It's not going to be awful. But then it still took me 2 years from that point to when I actually stopped. And those 2 years were, I'd say, the most difficult in terms of I was so living against what I really wanted to do. I was so out of alignment. I knew how alcohol made me feel. I was learning more about the science. I just knew the stuff that I needed to know, but I just couldn't stop and stay stopped. But I was stopping and starting. And then the last year I did two big stints and had like a slip up for where I drank 4 nights in a row. And then I did another like 60 days or something. And then I had a slip up for 3 nights in a row, and then that was it. And I didn't know at that point that that was going to be it, but nothing happened particularly. It was drinking at home when the kids were in bed, but it was my mental health was getting really bad because it was this kind of constant cycle of betrayal. Like I'd build myself up and I'd really think and say to my partner, you know, I think this is it this time. I had a coach, I was in group programs, I was doing all the stuff. But I just needed a couple of more lessons, and those last two blips, should we say, taught me what I needed to know, that it just wasn't for me. It was never going to be for me. I could never drink in the way that I wanted to drink. I had to get rid of the wine business, that I had to be able to move forward and feel free. And it just all became really clear. So, yeah.
It's so valid what you say there. And I know, because I work with them, you work with them, we all know, and especially with just Christmas behind us now, people slip up because the pressure feels so intense, because we maybe scoot back into our family home. We have the dynamics with our siblings where we revert back to teenage years. Uh-huh. We have all these patterns and roles that we embody, and that we nearly feel like we can't cope because we're so out of sync again. And, you know, that friction, I loved you talked about that earlier, but the slip ups are an important part of the learning process, aren't they?
So important.
Yeah.
So important. And I don't know many people that just, there are people, yeah, but I don't know many that wake up one day and say, I don't think this drinking's for me anymore, and stop and just stay stopped at that point. It generally tends to be a period of exploration. Like that's why I love the word curious so much. Like being sober curious, we're curious as to what could this look like? What could this feel like? Like how could I show up as a person who doesn't drink? What would a meal out with my friends feel like? All of these things that there's curiosity around, we go out and we find out, and it's all a learning. And then maybe, you know, people have a slip up and go back to drinking, and then are reminded as to how that feels, and it spurs them on a bit more, and this might go on for a while. And there's a narrative, isn't there, that it's a waste and we've got to reset day one, and all of this negative and there's so many negative emotions around slip ups. And I know it's difficult because you're putting a depressant back in your body after you've not put a depressant in your body, so it's going to feel not very nice, and there's going to be discomfort around that. But for most people, it is part of the process, and it does all, but it's all learning. And then suddenly, without us knowing, all of that learning just comes together, and we're in the position where we do manage to stop and stay stopped and find the acceptance. I think, I don't know about you, but the acceptance for me was huge, that I can't drink like I want to.
Yeah.
And that's okay. Like and that's okay, rather than having such resistance to it of, oh, but I really want to, and I really want to try again, and it's not fair. Like, why can't I just do what everybody else is doing? Like, why do I have to give my business up? Why? And then I just got to a point of, this is not going to work for me, and I have to find a different way to live and work and all of those things. And that's okay. And that's when it shifted.
But isn't that a metaphor for everything in our lives? So, Alison, as well, I can't drink like I want to. I can't shop like I want to. I can't eat what I want to. Like, and as we go through the ages, but I have to accept the reality of my life, or I don't have the relationship that I want to, or whatever it is. And it's the acceptance piece, accepting. Because, you know, I've got a couple, obviously we're just past Christmas, so I have a lot of clients, so I get a lot of texts and I get a lot of updates and stuff from people. And, you know, at Christmas time, well, you know, I just had the glass of Prosecco and I just thought I'd be absolutely grand or whatever. But and then on the contrast, I had texts from other people who were like, I've compared and contrasted this Christmas to last Christmas in terms of having alcohol in my body and not having alcohol in my body. And again, there's no comparison. So it's that kind of process of elimination. You know,
yeah,
I can never drink again, Alison. And, you know, I will never drink again. And I don't romanticize wine and Italy or New Zealand or South Africa or vineyards or anything. I'm like, that's a load of shit. That's not for me. I prefer like getting up early, meditating, all that nerdy stuff. But, you know, it's again that acceptance that that part of my life is over and I'm going to go into something better.
Yeah. And I think with alcohol, it's so difficult because we are made to believe that there's something wrong with us. Yeah. Should we not be able to drink in the way that we want to? I think that's where it's a bit more complicated than in other areas of our life, because it's such a kind of contrast from what you see on social media and without alcohol advertising to the reality for many people. So we blame ourselves and we feel shame around everybody else is managing to do this thing, but I'm not. So it's me that there's something wrong with. And I think that's where a lot of people get stuck, because they're stuck in this cycle of desperately wanting to do something that they perceive everybody else to be happily doing, the feeling of failing at doing it because they're drinking more than they want, or they feel a certain way when they drink, and then the shame or the blame that's piled on makes people want to drink again because they don't want to sit with that. And it's just a really vicious, it's a depressant. So we're putting a depressant in when we're already feeling potentially negative emotions. So it's just this horrible cycle that people get into and struggle to get out of. But as we both know, because we're coaching this, there's a way forward. There's a way forward for anyone who wants it. There is a way forward. I think it's realistic to know that it can take some time, and that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely. So you gave up in what year was it you gave up?
2021.
2021. So you had done the pandemic. You've done all that. And then what did your kind of last month of drinking like? And what was your stop story?
It was literally just, I hadn't been drinking. I was in a group coaching program. I had a one-to-one coach. Can't remember how many days it was on that second one, but say like 60 days in again. And it's just, you know, I always find, and I find with clients as well, that sometimes the bigger triggers are the small things. You know, for me, if something really big happened, I almost kind of went into self-preservation mode of, I couldn't drink on this. I couldn't put that in my body when this is happening. But it was just a few small things happened. And I just thought, nah, sod it. I'm going to drink tonight. And I did drink that night. And I think for three more nights, I had my coach on a Friday. So it was, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday nights I drank. I told her I had my coach on a Friday and we had our Friday session as usual. And then I stopped and stayed stopped. And like I said, it wasn't anything dramatic, but how low it made me feel. It was just starting to scare me. And it was just a self-betrayal. I didn't want to do it. It was just I hadn't quite, didn't have quite all of the tools that I needed at that point to put that pause in, you know, to hold off long enough to regulate my nervous system, to do all of the things that we need to practice doing in order to not reach for that drink. And I sat there, I poured it, and I sat there with this glass. I can remember it sat with this glass of white wine in my hand, probably for about 25 minutes, thinking, I don't want to drink this, but I'm going to now because I've poured it. And just knowing that I didn't want to, but I just didn't have the tools at that point to not drink the drink. And yeah, I mean, it was just 4 days of my son, who was only young then. He would have been about, where are we? About seven. So he knew that mommy wasn't drinking, and then he saw me drinking. And, you know, for them, it was all functioning. It wasn't catastrophic. But for me, it felt catastrophic. And I was uncomfortable that he knew mommy was trying not to drink because it didn't make her feel good. And then she was drinking again. And I think they're very perceptive and that didn't feel good. The whole thing just felt awful. And I just thought, oh my gosh, what are you doing? You know how good you feel when you don't drink, or how much better you feel. And it was just what I needed. I just got the lessons from that last lip that that propelled me forward.
Yeah, amazing. And, you know, I think we all, a lot of us underestimate, well, because we're kind of gaslit into not knowing the full extent of the habit. Like, alcohol is a psychoactive drug, right? It really disrupts our brain chemistry. So it disrupts our mood. It disrupts our level of balance. It disrupts so many things. It affects every single system in our body, right? So, like, when we give it up and we realize we're more, our mood is more stable, we can, we have a greater tolerance for discomfort. Like, we learn all these things about ourselves, but we didn't know that it was affecting us as deeply. And like towards the end, I wasn't drinking a whole pile. Do you know what I mean? Because the kids were small and, you know, but it was still enough to really disrupt me and my potential and all these things. And these are the gorgeous things you discover about yourself. So like, what have you discovered about yourself in the last 4 and a bit years?
I think for me, just real understanding and doing some work around what my values are has been huge.
Yeah.
Somebody said to me when I was drinking, this was probably around 2019, it was a coach in a program that was on. She said, oh, you're really living out of alignment with your values, aren't you? And I kind of thought, oh, what does she mean? I have no idea what she meant. And then when I did my values work, I was like, oh, that's what she meant. And just understanding and starting to accept myself for who I actually am rather than pretending was huge. And understanding the things that are important to me and that I hold close and that, like, the values that I want to live by and how I want to show up, and just gradually moving into those. And I suppose, and it has been, it wasn't easy, but that ability now to show up as exactly who I am, you know, I don't, with all of the wine business stuff, I don't have to pretend anymore. Everybody knows that I'm an alcohol-free coach, and, you know, that whole process was really difficult of, because I knew quite quickly, because I'd been stopping and starting for so long at that point, I knew I had to change career, and I knew quite quickly, because my coach was amazing, I knew quite quickly what I wanted to do. So I trained but didn't tell anyone. And then, you know, it was time to kind of come out and say, I don't drink. I don't think I'd even said that I didn't drink publicly. And I'm not somebody that puts things on my, like, Facebook page at all, personal things. So for me to have to go on and say, I know I had a wine company last year. Actually, no, I've stopped drinking and I don't think I'm ever going to drink again. And I've retrained. Obviously, it wasn't worded like that, but that was basically what it was. And it was so uncomfortable. But then gradually I have, over the last few years, just gotten comfortable with this version of me, this me who is authentic and who tells the truth and who shows up in a way that she wants to. Most of the time, obviously, stopping drinking doesn't make us, like, make it perfect in any way, shape or form. It is all an ongoing learning. But I'm so grateful that I have got the capacity and the headspace to learn about myself now.
Yeah. And you said there, like, the truth, like, I know at my core, I'm a truth teller. Like, I cannot. Well, I hope I am. But, you know, it is what it is. Like, let's call it out. Do you know what I mean? So let's say it as it is, you know. And I just think your story, like, it not just involves, I've said this before, but, like, you literally had to change how you earned money. So, and, like, the discomfort. So there's kind of, like, there's even more, there was more at stake for you than there is for, you know, the majority of people listening to this. So, like, the bravery is just unbelievable.
And the bit about it that was most uncomfortable for me, obviously I was panicking like mad about the money, the finances, how we were going to cope, but we did. We coped and we're recovering from that. But the bit that was most uncomfortable for me was, are my wine clients going to think that I've just lied to them for years so they spend money with me? That's how it felt like. I thought that's how people may perceive it, and that felt so uncomfortable to me. And obviously it wasn't like that. I set up the wine business with good intention. I remember thinking, if I can just moderate, I'll be able to have this business and it will be great. I've just got to learn to moderate. That's all I kept saying. I've just got to learn to moderate. I've just got to get better at moderating. And then it kind of got to, right, well, I'll just have to stop drinking and keep it a secret. But I just couldn't. There were things that came up, like one of my clients' dads had gifted her this really expensive bottle of wine. And I'd met him at a tasting and he said, you can have this, but you've got to share it with Alison. So she was saving it for me. She was trying to, like, was the invite me around to drink it. And I kept making excuses. And it was so uncomfortable. I just knew that I couldn't continue like that. And the intention was to set up a wine business, to get my drink into where I wanted it to be, and to like run community events and bring people together. And I had it for, it was about 8 years, and I did, like, that did happen. Like the events, the same people came month in and month out. So I got to know them really well. They became family friends. So it was really uncomfortable for me to think, oh, like, what are they going to think about this? Are they going to think that I lied the whole time just to get them to spend money? And I don't know what they thought, because they've never told me. And I've had to just come to peace with that. My intention never was that at the time that I set up the wine industry. You know, I really believed that bringing people together to enjoy wine, that's how I saw it then, because I didn't know what I know now about it as a substance, could potentially be a positive thing. And my relationship changed with it so much that, you know, it wasn't positive in my life. And I just had to bite that bullet. And I think the difficulty of it was that I would see people come to the tastings, like groups of school moms, for example, have a lovely time and go off and like carry on with their life and be up the next day and feel fine. And that used to kind of, I'd do all the work. So I'd be on course, I'd be having my coach, and I'd be reading the books, listening to podcasts. And then I'd see these people come and have a lovely time. And it used to kind of undo, like rebrainwash me. So it's like, I just want what they have. I want to be able to do that with my friends. They can do it. Like, this looks really nice. Nobody's getting really drunk. It's wine tasting. It's not like a free for all. They couldn't order extra drinks. It was a kind of limited amount. It made me really want that. So I was just kind of constantly like toing and froing between wanting to be a drinker and not wanting to be a drinker. But then quite often people would say things like, oh, did you give us more last month than you normally do, because I was really drunk. And then they'd say things like, well, we did go to the pub after and we shared like a couple of bottles of wine. So again, I was seeing a snippet of that night. I wasn't seeing the full picture, but that made it really tricky to kind of bite the bullet and make the changes that I needed to make.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it's our perception of things, and we can't do anything based on what other people do. We have to do what's right for us. Just a little aside there, like, and you might talk a bit about this, like, you know, when you drink an expensive, like, what's the most expensive bottle of wine that you've drank?
Good few £100.
Okay. So that still has, so, but if you look at that and maybe a can of cheap cider, like 50p or 50 cent or whatever, like, it still goes into your system the exact same way. It's just a perception of it, you know. So like, if we've somebody who's drinking, actually, and Denzel Washington talked about this. So he tried to moderate his drinking for a long time. And he was saying, well, look, at if I drink $10,000 bottles of wine, I can't have a problem then, because it's the best.
Yeah.
But he did. And he had to give up alcohol there as well. So there's that misperception that, you know, it's fancy, and the more expensive it drinks, that, you know, maybe the less hangover. But it doesn't work like that, because the drug is still the drug. Ethanol is still ethanol. It still moves through our body the same way. It still depresses our central nervous system. It still messes with the balance in our lives. It still is a very high driver of suicide, domestic violence, murder, all of these kind of things. But we're like, no, it's great crack, but sorry, it's causing all these things. You know, it costs our healthcare system 11% of its budget. I know it's the same in the UK, yet we're all like, no, it's great crack, why aren't you doing it? And you're like, sorry. It's not really.
I have a client, and we've talked about this a lot. She lives in America. And we've worked really hard to get that past the perception of nice wine, because she'll find it okay to go for dinner in a restaurant where the wine isn't nice. But then if she's going to her perceived restaurants that have nice wine, she'll feel triggered, and like the constant kind of reinforcement, none of it's nice, like none of it is nice. It is all the same thing. It's a depressant, it's an anesthetic, it's toxic. And I suppose, you know, that was difficult for me to come to terms with, because that's what I was trained in, the nice wines and having to accept. And I learned that from myself. What I learned, well, I learned the science, and learning the science is so important, you know, what alcohol is and does, like you said. But also from my own experiences, what happened was I'd be having a break. I'd show like a wine at a wine tasting. Everyone would drink it and be like, oh, wow, this is really lovely. And then I'd obsess about that wine. And I'd be like, oh my gosh, I really want like a bottle of that wine. And it would be in the garage, and I'd obsess about it for weeks or months or days, for however long, until I caved and drank, and it would taste disgusting. And I was always like, oh, it doesn't even taste nice. And that was when, it was when I took the breaks, and my taste buds weren't used to alcohol. That was when I realized that alcohol does not taste nice. And some people that I work with don't get to the point of acceptance on that. For them, they feel that alcohol does taste nice, and we work around that. But for many people who have stopped and started again, it's the realization that it doesn't even taste nice.
And that also brings up the point where, like, our thoughts aren't true. So your brain was telling you, go on, that wine, that wine, that wine. And in reality, you're like, no, you stop lying to me. So it's that kind of very conscious thing of really examining your thoughts, really fleshing them out, you know, that catch it, challenge it, change it, you know. So we're looking at our thoughts, and are they actually true, or is it our brain's way of keeping us safe and keeping us the same as well? You know, you can tell your brain anything.
Yeah. And if it did taste nice, so for those people that feel that for them, whatever their drink is, does taste really nice, are there other drinks that don't contain alcohol that do taste nice? And one of the questions that I find really interesting was, if it didn't contain alcohol, would that still be your choice? So for red wine, for example, a lot of people say, oh, I like the taste of red wine, and there's nothing that's like it in terms of an alcohol-free alternative. But if it didn't contain alcohol in red wine, would that still be a choice? And that makes quite a lot of people really think, oh, actually, maybe it wouldn't. So again, it's our thoughts. Are we being really honest with ourselves? Because and our subconscious is responsible for a lot of it, and we can lie to ourselves without realizing. It's a protective measure of our brain to make us have more of a positive perception of ourselves. It's not our fault, but it's really important to be curious around all of the beliefs that we have, and question them, challenge them, explore them, journal on them, so that we can get really clear on what is really happening and what the real pull to having a drink is, so that then we can challenge and work through that, because we don't crave what we don't want. So if we really look at all of the benefits that we believe we're getting from alcohol and systematically work through them and look at what really happens when we have an alcoholic drink, that is also a big change moment, I find with my clients, and it was for me as well.
Absolutely. And like we always say on here, it's an incremental process. Like you know, you did, it was 15 years for you. It was probably 23 for me. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'd say the 10th time I drank, I blacked out. Do you know what I mean? So like it got hairy kind of soon, you know? But look at, as we were saying earlier, like, we drank like everybody around us. Like, was their drinking normal? I don't know what's normal drinking, but you know, it didn't serve me in the end. We are now in the bang smack in the middle of dry January, right? So I did a load of dry Januaries, they obviously all added up, and then I gave up for good. But it is a great way. And, you know, I mentioned this on last week's podcast, but new research has come out to show how powerful it is to take a break from alcohol. So do you have any tips for the listeners who might be, you know, I don't know, dry January is easy if you're coming off the back of like a heavy enough December, but like, what are your tips for success?
I think for me and my experience working with people on dry January is that people tend to come in feeling a bit jaded, you know. It's not like a mid-year break where people think, oh, this might be a really positive thing for me to do. It tends to be, I've overdone it, and therefore I need to do something to feel better or to rectify that. So for me, mindset's really important, to just go into it with as much of a positive mindset as possible, around reframing it, not as something that you have to do because you've like overdone it, but something that's a gift, like a break from the booze is a gift, you know, in terms of what it does to our mind and body, and just giving us that like mental clarity and headspace and consistency and all of these amazing things. So to go into it as positively as possible, as opposed to, you know, feeling like it's something that you have to do. And I'd say just focus on the month and don't put too much pressure on, you know, focus on the month and doing the month and feeling as good as possible during that month. And then at the end of the month, people can think about what comes next. Because a lot of the people that I work with are questioning, like they feel that they need to do Dry January, and then they're questioning what happens at the end. And I don't want to go back to that, but I'd say focus on the month for now. So there's no pressure on what comes next, and just take it a day at a time and break it down into sizable chunks. And I would also say really focus on things other than alcohol. So we tend to just focus on this. It's got to be, I've got to not drink, I've got to not drink. And that's the focus. But bring in new things, like do new things. I always encourage my clients, well, anyone actually. I think it's a lovely thing to do on New Year's Day. Me and my partner and the kids, we all write a joy list every year. It's our little thing. So a list of things that bring us joy. And they can be tiny little things like, you know, like nice stationery or a nice candle, or it can be like big things like travel, or, you know, things like going out on the bikes or getting out into nature. Whatever it is, write a joy list of all the things that bring you joy and just try and implement new things and focus on all of the bits that are going to boost you up and make you feel positive and bring that joy in, as opposed to making it all about the alcohol. Because if we are active in changing other bits in our life, then that can really help with the motivation to stay alcohol free. If we just change what's in our glass and sit on the same seat on the same sofa every night, but with an alcohol free alternative, feeling like we're missing out, it's going to be a different experience. So I would say try and mix it up and make it more of a holistic approach, as opposed to I'm just stopping drinking. What are the other wonderful things that can come off the back of that?
Yeah, absolutely. When we take the booze out, we need to put in other things to kind of, because like drinking takes a lot of time, you know, and it's about like it's that, about that constant reframe. So it's constantly checking your thoughts, constantly reframing them into something that's, you know, I suppose more conducive to change as well, you know, because most of us have given alcohol thousands of chances. Most of us have spent, pointing to myself, hundreds of thousands of euro, Alison, on the booze, you know, but it's about giving it a new chance, you know, or giving something else a new chance as well. And did you do Dry Januaries?
No, never completed one. Okay. Never.
Okay.
The only times I did like a successful alcohol free month were when I were on, you know, organized programs, and I never was for January, which is sometimes what tends to be the case, that in January people go solo because there's so much brilliant free advice. But for me, I needed more than that. I needed the accountability, I needed like coaching, I needed connection. So no, I never managed to do, I think I probably got to maybe the sixth, and that was the best that I ever did.
And it's amazing that you know, community, accountability, all of these things really do help us as well.
Oh, so much, yeah. And that in itself is a massive gift of not drinking. The people that come in, the conversations that you have, it's huge. Like one of the ladies on my group coaching last night said, if I were to take myself away from my alcohol-free communities, like I wouldn't have conversations like these. And it's so nice to be able to have them, deeper conversations. I just find there's a mutual understanding.
Yeah.
From the people that have also stopped drinking, I just feel as a mutual understanding and almost like a willingness to be able to explore all things in life a bit deeper. And that, it for me, has been one of the best things that's come from being sober, and I love it. And that is just wonderful. I'm so grateful for that.
Yeah, it's amazing. It is truly amazing. And maybe to do a bit of quantum leaping and see what you'll be like this time next year, you know, when alcohol doesn't, and look at your testament to that. I'm testament to that. All the people that we know, you know, you said earlier, you've never met somebody who's raging that they gave up the booze. Everyone loves it, don't they?
It's funny though, isn't it? Because I don't think you can know really. It's, yeah. So to imagine what a year would look like, I don't think you really can.
Yeah.
So it's really important to just, I had to really trust the people that were saying,
yeah,
this is going to get easier and it's going to feel comfortable and you're going to feel good. And,
yeah,
you know, I had to really trust them because I didn't trust myself. I had no trust in myself by the time that I stopped. So I had to trust the people that had gone before me and just trust the process. I just had to get my head down and think, this is going to feel more comfortable soon.
Yeah.
And it did.
And it's funny because I did it all by myself in kind of 2017, 2018. So I didn't know anybody. Like the first book that I read was Catherine Gray's book. So like I just knew that I couldn't feel hungover anymore. It was appalling. My hangovers were so bad. But I now want to be the person to the other people that I needed. And that's my motivation because I know
I
how people feel because we've lived it. Alison, thank you. I've loved it. I really have. And where do people contact you if they want to connect with you?
So my website's Alison Calder, that's CALDER.com. And then my Facebook's Alison Calder Coaching, my Instagram, Alison Calder Alcohol Coach. But thank you. I've loved talking to you.
I know, it's really great. And we'll stay in contact, won't we?
Yes, definitely.
Yes, we will. Happy New Year, Alison.
Oh, Happy New Year.
No More Booze, the podcast, is produced, mixed and mastered at the studios of Irish Audio Drama. For more information, visit irishaudiodrama.com.